Hey, hey, hey. Thanks very much indeed for showing up for this episode 11 of the What's Racing About podcast, The Wrap, the podcast that ensures that you get the most out of UK and Irish horse racing. My name's Peter Bell, and I've got what I think is a real treat for you in this episode. In the second ever episode of The Wrap, I did a preview of National Racehorse Week and followed this up in episode 6 with a review of that week. And that featured some live footage from Richard Phillips' yard down in Adelstrop. Richard and his team put on a real fun, open and educational day at the start of National Racehorse Week. And the couple of hundred or so guests that turned up found out a hell of a lot more about racing and the care and attention that's lavished on horses that provide such entertainment for us. As part of that morning, one of Richard's young novice hurdlers was given a jumping masterclass under jockey Tom Bellamy. The session was delivered by the racing performance consultant Yogi Breisner. Now, go back and have a listen to episode 6 for a full picture of what this entailed. But basically, it's one of the most fascinating 45 or so minutes that I've spent in the racing game. I'll learn more about what makes a horse tick, and more specifically, how to get a horse to jump then than I've ever done in my entire life. I knew I had to interview Yogi and find out more about his life's work with horses. And that's not just racehorses, but that's point-to-pointers, eventers, dressage horses, etc., as we'll find out. Fast forwards then to late October, when I sat down with the man and passed what was easily one of the top 20 hours of my life chatting with him about, well, pretty much all things thoroughbred and wider even than that. Here's what I captured from our meeting.
When we met at Richard's, it was like just such an eye-opener. And the first and most interesting sort of question, how on earth does somebody become a performance expert in such a niche area?
That niche market has existed for as long as national hunt racing has existed in many aspects, because there were always people that would take national hunt horses hunting. There would always be horsemen, I would call them, who would take on horses that were maybe a little bit backwards, a little bit slow, not necessarily slow enough speed, but slow in learning and taking time to mature and so on. And they would work away with those ones and they would jump them, etc. There were people I remember back from the 70s who specialized in loose jumping racehorses and preparing them from that point of view. So it's kind of always been around. I have always had an interest in racing, loved racing right from the very beginning. I did do a little bit of race riding in my teens when I lived in Sweden, jump racing, but it's a very small sport in Sweden. I dabbled a little bit with point-to-pointing when I lived in Ireland and enjoyed that. Then eventing kind of took over, and that became my main area of where I was first a competitor and then a coach. And the place where I, when I first came over to England, Waterstock House Training Centre, where Lars Sederholm had a big training establishment, and there were some trainers that would send horses to his yard to be schooled and get time to mature, and I often got to ride those horses and play about with them and jump them a bit and do things with them. And then I left in 1991 and started to be what they call a freelance riding instructor and travel around.
So it's a conscious decision then to actually become a performance expert.
When I went freelance, I was doing a lot of coaching within the pony club and riding clubs and obviously eventing. And the advantage with eventing is that it's an all-round thing. So you do the dressage, you do the jumping, you do the cross-country. And the cross-country, of course, horses have to get fit. And in those days, we had a steeplechase element of the three-day event.
Indeed, yeah. So
you were kind of used to that. And then a very good old close friend of mine, Henrietta Knight, she, of course, produced a lot of event horses. I used to ride them for her. And then she started with the point-to-pointing, and I helped to jump a few of her point-to-pointers and worked a little bit with some of the jockeys that she had in the yard.
And who have been the jockeys in this is the 90s?
She had someone called David Naylor Leyland that rode for her a lot. And so these were amateurs because she was point-to-pointing.
Yes.
And Johnny Ruffell, who tragically died in a road accident. And then in the early 90s, when I was doing freelancing, one or two other trainers started to use me, and I started to jump horses. I went down to their places. I sometimes took horses in. I still used Waterstock House Training Centre as a base to take some race horses in. And then it kind of, I suppose, the label performance and those sort of thing came in that.
I was going to say, do you shy at the word guru or do you?
Yeah, a little bit I do. But what happened was that there was a horse that won a novice chase at Ludlow and then went on to win the big novice chase at Kempton over Christmas. And the trainer gave me quite an accolade for having helped with the jumping. Mm-hmm. And a few days later, it froze over, so I was no racing for 2-3 weeks. And all the racing journalists, they were dying to find things to write about. And that was this yogi who had helped get this horse to jump, who had won this race, etc. And, of course, the trainers, they couldn't do schooling outside because we had snow and frost and so on. So they kind of, we schooled quite a lot of horses indoors. And there were quite a lot of journalists that was interested in what I was doing, which gave me a kind of a push of publicity. And that kind of labelled it a little bit from that point of view. And I had also around that time started to go to the British Racing School at Newmarket, where I was helping out with the jump coaching of potential jump jockeys on what now are the licensing courses. So they used to run voluntary courses for young aspiring jump jockeys that would prepare them for racing. And that then over the years eventually grew into what is now the licensing courses for both apprentices and conditional jockeys.
Do you work with, so it's mostly working with horses or with jockeys?
Right. It started with the horses.
Yes.
But then it rolled on into the jockeys fairly soon. And I literally just finished this summer with the British Racing School. So I spent very nearly 30 years going there for the licensing courses. So that's the amateur courses, the professional courses in the conditional jockeys, the continuation courses, and all of the point-to-point courses. So all the jump training side, I would go in and do both theoretically when we lectured about it, but also practical when they had to ride. And
good memories of those 30 years?
Very, very. I mean, the British Racing School has grown from a small, efficient place to a very big, very efficient place. And, you know, it was in the very early days when they didn't really have horses there jumping, when they had the amateur courses, they brought their own horses to ride and met some very nice people and interesting people through that work there.
And who are the sort of jockeys that you've worked with over the years?
Since probably late 90s, all jump jockeys either had to sit a course at the Northern Racing School or at the British Racing School at Newmarket.
Okay.
So everyone that sat that course there, I've seen over the years.
Right.
on the jumping side. That is just for the licensing. But then other jockeys, they have come to me privately afterwards, or we have talked about things on the telephone, or I advise things. And it boils into a little bit of a combination, because like I might go into a trainer's yard to jump his horses, but the jockeys will be there, and then I would work with the jockeys to get the best out of it. Can out of the horse, and that means that I might say to them, well, why don't we try this, or do a bit more like that, or adjust a little bit in your position here, and those sort of areas which
yes.
can then help the horse, but will indirectly help the jockey as well.
And are they largely receptive to that?
National hand jockeys to me are sportsmen of the very, very highest calibre. They extremely professional, they are brave, they are naturally very, very fit. And they have a very open mind, because in the end of the day, they are all wanting to get better in what they're doing. And it's a very exposed sport. I mean, you have got, of course, the big sports like football, rugby, cricket and so on is very exposed, but it's only exposed on the very highest level. So if you know how many would watch a game of the National League football on a Saturday
yes.
afternoon, but every race in the country that is run under rules is televised and shown on television.
Yeah.
And whether it's an amateur race or a conditional jockey's race, it's shown. It, the only that doesn't come in is, of course, the amateur side of the point-pointing. As you talked about earlier, the public is there. They have put their hard-earned money they have paid tax
yeah.
on. And then you have someone that they think could have done the job better. And they get scrutinized. So if you think of that, you are a jockey, you are scrutinized by the trainer, you're scrutinized by the owner, you're scrutinized by the television pundits,
of course,
and you're
yeah,
scrutinized
yeah.
by the public
yeah.
and the gambling public. You know, there's a lot of scrutiny that goes on from that point of view. So And that's why they want to have a very open mind. They want to improve in what they're doing. And they are fantastic people to work with, I must say. They're the best. But some people do say, you know, if they are a jump trainer, why should they need a jumping person like me coming in? No one can know and do everything and be good at and concentrate on everything. So the trainer, or they are basically the person in charge that is leading the whole operation. And then they have got stable staff looking after the horses. They have got expert coming in, advising on the surface that they are working on. They will have a farrier coming in because he is the expert on feet. And they might have a physiotherapist coming in. I'm just part of that support team.
Yes.
So they might use, the flat trainer might use a specialist to get help horses with the starting stalls. I come in to help the jump trainers with the jumping.
And is it a largely reactive business? So you wait for the phone call to come from a trainer?
It would be the trainer that would contact me. And there have been a few occasions when an owner would have contacted me about the horse, and then I would always go back to the trainer. So I would always work through the trainer rather than directly with an owner. No disrespect to the owner, but it's the trainer that trains the horse. He knows the horse inside out, and he is that one that I would then do the communication with. There are obviously some owners that would run an operation at home where they might have the horses at home before they go into training.
Yes.
And they might bring me in to help with the jumping at that place before, which is different. Then there are some trainers over the years where I might have worked a lot with, and we have had a very close working relationship. And then I might have come, look, I think with that horse, if we do this, it might just help his jumping in the long run. But that would be the rarity. It's more that the trainer would come to me.
So you worked with Henrietta Knight doing point-to-pointing.
Yeah,
and then when she trained under rules as well. And who are the other trainers?
There are a lot of trainers over the years. Like, I've done a lot of work with Nicky Henderson over the years. Some trainers might have just one horse that they need help with, and others use me generally across the board with the horses. And sometimes it's just a different pair of eyes. Yeah, I would just come in and I would watch a schooling morning, and then we would discuss a few things afterwards. It could be something that we would change or do slightly different.
And at what point do you get involved with jumping aspects of a horse? Is it when a horse starts to show problems, or is it right from the early days when they've just been broken in?
It depends a lot.
And when do you prefer to get involved as well, I suppose?
That depends very much on the trainer and what's been done. I mean, I have had some trainers that I have worked with when they bought horses off the flat. They would come from the sales ring to me to jump before they went into the yard. And other trainers would do the beginning themselves, or they use other people that they would send the horses to. And I would only be brought in when maybe things have gone a little bit wrong. I mean, horses comes in shapes and sizes and ability the same as human beings. You can have 100 people kicking a football, and you have anything from Ronaldo down to someone that is, you know, pretty average. And it's the same thing with the horses. And just because we breed them specifically for racing doesn't necessarily mean that they're all going to be the best in the world. So some horses might need more help than others might. And sometimes it's just simply doing something different with them, which can sometimes trigger it. And a lot of the time I would have worked with horses and think that I've improved them, and then they come on the racetrack and it still falls to bit. And other times I've got a lot of accolades for, oh, this horse went to yogis and it really improved him. And I honestly would say I made no difference whatsoever. It was just pure chance that the horse has got better.
I know when we were at Richard's and you did that really fascinating session. I just wish you'd taken a video of it. I could show people this is what went into it. One of the questions that I asked you immediately after that was that horse, that was at the end of the summer. That horse was going to be, or Richard had thought it would probably be more of a soft ground horse. So there's obviously a time delay between you doing the schooling session and then seeing a race course. So in schooling terms, you know, in human schooling terms, it's like doing a crammer session for an exam, but then not taking the exam sort of until several months later. How much is retained by the horse?
Again, it depends very much on the horse. Sometimes one or two sessions is enough. and the penny drops and the horse actually improves for it and gets better. And other times they need reminders all the time. Depending on what sort of system a trainer operates as well. I mean, some trainers would have a specific schooling morning and they would school as many horses as they feel necessary and need to school, and depending on how many riders they have. I mean, if you are a big yard and you have one training session a week, physically, you wouldn't be able to school 100 horses. Some people might school twice a week. Like a lot of the things, it's the practice that is needed and the repetition of doing things again and again and again that makes them better. But of course, every time you jump, you put strain on the horse and you increase the accident risk. You know, there is a balance between how much you do and how much you... what is needed, because in the end of it, the less you can do, the better for the horse, as long as the horse still learns what he needs to learn to be able to do it on the racetrack, if you understand what I mean with that. And there have been horses that I have jumped in the morning of the race because we felt that that's what they needed. They have actually brought the horse to me on the way to the racetrack. You know, it helped the horse and it needed a reminder. And so some horses that might get a little bit excited, a little bit worked up, to actually drop in on the way, have a few jumps and then go to the racetrack, actually has helped them.
So it's a very bespoke, horse-specific service.
Yes.
That you know, and you need to really get inside the horse and the trainer's mind to be able to understand that it's not one size fits all operation.
That's right. And I mean, if you think to be a racehorse trainer and you have got maybe 80, 100, 120 horses in training, it's a bit like being a football manager and you have got a squad of, say, 25 or 30 players or something like that, that is all part of your top team and you training them. And what you need to do is to put together a system that means that all those players or all those horses is going to be able to get as close as possible to that natural ability and utilize and get to that natural ability. So you put together a system of training them to get them fit. But then some of them might need individual attention on top of that. If you train that number of horses, you don't have an hour and a half to spend on one horse or two horses or three horses. And that's why someone like myself might come in. I can then spend that time on them in order to help them along. Like, you know, you might take a striker out of the team that has lost their form a little bit, and you might work specifically with that striker outside the rings of the team.
That's really interesting to hear you put it in those sort of human footballing terms. I think that's something that a lot of the listeners will be able to empathise with. I mean, in terms of, you know, the Ronaldos and the bang average strikes and so on, in horse racing terms, who are the success stories, if you like? If you look at a horse and go, I'm really proud of the work that I did with that. And are there some horses, in the words of like Cool Hand Luke, that you just cannot reach?
Often it's the horses that goes on and wins a big race that is the ones that you get remembered for. But behind every horse and behind every success with a horse is a teamwork. You know, the trainer, the jockey, the stable staff that looks after the horses, gallop man for keeping the gallops right and everything. You know, it's a whole team. And I'm just one small little cog in that team. Of course, if a horse has come out and turned upside down a few times and then he stands on his feet and wins a big race, then maybe for that particular horse, my cog was slightly bigger than it would have been on another horse. The same as if a horse has had a soundness issue and the vet has stepped in and sorted that soundness issue out, then if it that horse, the vet has might have had a slightly bigger cog in the machinery. And I've never, right from the very beginning, I have never talked about individual horses. When people have asked me about, you mentioned horses you've worked with, I have refrained from actually bringing out names as such. But naturally, if you have a horse that you have spent a bit of time with and you see them win, or even if they don't win, but they actually jump well and gain a good place, it's very, very satisfactory. Yeah. And if you then get a horse that wins a big race and you get publicity about it, you wouldn't be human if you didn't make it feel good. But sometimes the bits that is very satisfying is when you have worked either with a rider or with a horse and you can see an improvement, and it might not lead to a success, but there is still an improvement. That's yeah. Very good. I don't think there is anyone in the world who has got into being with horses and making horses a career that didn't start out because they loved horses and they had a fascination of the horse as an animal. And then it becomes a career and a business and all of those things, and the horse might be more of a commodity throughout that thing. But that underlying fascination and love and respect for the horse that you develop is there. So when you see really good-looking horse coming into an arena, you're going to do a bit of work with it, and you look at it and you think, gosh, that is a real nice horse, then that's work satisfaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, you get a few horses that might not be cooperative and might find it difficult, but then that becomes a challenge because then you think, now, what can I do to improve that horse? And in the end of it, the horse might run three times and then and won't do much good at all, but you can still feel satisfaction because with what you were doing with the horse, it slightly improved.
Yeah.
You know, standing at Cheltenham and seeing something that you have worked with coming up the hill and winning is just very, very satisfying. If you have then have worked with the jockey as well, and you might have discussed and had a plan and put it together and all that comes to fruition, then it is very, very satisfactory.
We've talked about horses in training, and obviously at the moment in the industry, there's a large focus on post-racing careers. And I know you're very much involved with the retraining of horses post-racing careers. How did you get involved with that? And is that as equally as satisfying for you to be able to take a horse such as Cato Star, for example,
absolutely.
And then put them into a dressage arena? And how easy is it for them to take a horse that's come from a racing firmament and put them into something sort of as buzzy as a National Hunt Racing?
Yes, they are all bred to be star horses, but that is not necessarily going to be the case. And so therefore, there are now the retraining of racehorses who is run by a lady called Di Arbuthnot, whose husband David Arbuthnot used to train. And I've known Di since she was actually riding herself, because she was a jockey and she used to come and ride some horses that I jumped with. And she asked me to get involved right from the very early mm-hmm. days through the education and things. And there are also a lot of charities out there that takes in racehorses and reskills them. The thoroughbred horse is a wonderful creature in that they find it very, very easy to adapt, very easy to change around.
How easy is it to take something that's been the star of the show, won at Cheltenham, and then we all age, needs to retire, hopefully it's in sound wind and sound health. Mentally, how difficult is the transfer from that level of competitiveness to something less active and less sort of intense?
Well, you only have to go to Horse of the Year show or to these showing classes for retraining of racehorses classes, and you see maybe 10, 12, 15 horses in the show ring going round, trotting, cantering round, being judged on their conformation and how they're going and how they're riding. And all of them are racehorses by the stage of their life.
Yeah.
And they're enjoying it, and it gives them a purpose. Because as we know, the career for a racehorse is over fairly early. So if you're looking on the flat, by the time they're 4, 5, 6, they're probably most of their career with one or two exceptions. And in jump racing, they might go on to their 8, 9, 10, 12 years of age.
Yes.
But then again, there's a long life for them afterwards. It is something that has always existed because people have always wanted to buy horses out of racing. And there are a lot of horses that have gone into polo from racing. There are quite a few horses that have gone into eventing from racing. And then it's not just at the end of that career, but it's also that those racehorses that might not have been good enough to have a career, they can go in to be riding horses fairly soon, as it were.
And is there something innately tractable about the thoroughbred racehorse that makes them able to go into dressage, eventing, show jumping?
People often think, well, you know, to go into other disciplines, and then people think, you know, where on the ladder? Because like in racing, you go to lower-end racing, and you have got the Gold Cups, and you have got the classic races. So there is quite a range. And that's the same thing in eventing, dressage, show jumping, in polo and everything else. You know, so in dressage, the lower prelim classes like that, they are a mile away from what you see in the Olympic Games. But of course, that's the shop window. So you say to people that, oh, this horse is going into dressage, the dressage that the general public sees is what is done on the very highest level. And the majority of horses that are bred, whether they are thoroughbred horses for racing or cart horses or ponies or whatever, can trot around a little dressage arena. They might not get 75% of scores. They might only get 50%, but they can still do it.
Yes.
It's just literally the same thing as if you take the one of the, in the world, probably widest range of human sporting that is done is golf. Because you have got the very top end of it, and then you have got myself hacking away from time to time, hitting more divots than balls, and, you know, absolutely delighted if you score under 135. and you know, that doesn't mean that just because of that, I can't enjoy golf. So, and the same thing with the horses, there is that range around that. And the thoroughbred horse, as I said, has got a wonderful way of adapting to what they are doing. And when they are in training, they are kept very, very fit. They are fed high-octane food, in other words, the low high-protein, to make them perform. If you take them out of that environment, you make them slightly less fit. You do less galloping work and more normal work. And if you then reduce their feed down to more of a normal level, then they become, if you like it, more of a normal riding horse. The ex-race horse would be similar. And some people adapt sooner rather than others. But like with a human being, if you retire from anything, particularly something that has been very involving and that you did, someone that business would be the same.
Yeah.
If you've had someone that is right into business, running their own business, working 24/7, taking very, very few holidays, and then they sell their business, they've got X number of pounds in the bank because they've sold their business. They wake up on a Monday morning and they say, what am I going to do now? And it leads to various things where they find difficult and they look for other things. And I know a lot of businessmen who sell their business and then start another one because they just can't live without it. And to me, that's where the retraining of racehorses and finding alternative careers for them rather than just turning them out in the field, I think is important.
Yes.
Because it gives them a purpose. And that keeps them healthy. That's not to say that if you just turn them out, then they would be extremely happy about that because it brings them right back to nature, as long as they are looked after when they are in that environment. But it is easier to look after them if you have got a purpose for them. And I think it's done extremely well in this country. But like with everything in life, there are always going to be something that goes a bit wrong. However good a system we have among human beings, there are going to be people who end up having to sleep on the streets. There are going to be people who choose a criminal career. And therefore, within the racing industry, however well it's run and looked after, and I think it is looked after, there are always going to be one or two horses who ends up in the wrong hands at the wrong time, and consequently will suffer.
Yes.
And if you as a journalist seek those ones out, then you can show the industry in a bad picture.
Yes.
I have worked within the industry for all my life, and I must say that to me, what is done in the racing industry is unique, and these horses are, on the whole, generally speaking, across the board, looked after very, very well from the time when they are born until the time when they have to be euthanized because or they die a natural death. I did a training day for the retraining of racehorses in Richmond in Yorkshire, and there was an audience that to watch it, and we got various racehorses in, and there was a lovely looking horse that came in, trotted around. And if someone had asked me how old I thought that horse was, I would have said, this is probably someone in the region of 6, 7, 8 year olds. That horse was 17 years of age. It started his career on the flat as a 2 year old. It raced 2, 3 year olds on the flat, then it went into hurdling, then went into chasing. When it was finished with chasing, it did eventing, show jumping, and a bit of dressage, and it was now doing shearing classes, age 17, and looked as young and fresh as anything else. And to me, that is just proof of the versatility of the thoroughbred horse, but it's also a credit to the people who has looked after that horse from start to finish.
And it's interesting, the analogy that you've made about if you go looking for issues and problems, I don't know how many horses are in training per year, some of them will fall through the cracks and some of them will end up in places where they shouldn't be, let's be honest. But by and large, I think it's an industry that is caring. Turn to the future now. What does the future hold? Do you have ambitions to go into small p politics of racing and looking after the welfare of racehorses further from a political point of view?
The step down as the performance manager for the British team in 2016 after the Rio Olympics, with a view of that I was going to take it easier, work myself into retirement. As long as I am healthy and I can't see myself not having an interest. And my job, I'm very fortunate, is in that I can use it as a hobby. It started as a hobby and it's now come back as a hobby. That doesn't mean that I do everything for free, because I do still charge a commercial rate in what I'm doing things. But if people come along and want to have some advice about something, I'm delighted to have an involvement and to do it. The retirement means that I do so little that I feel that I can't stay up to date with things and sharp enough with it, then I probably will put the clothes shop sign up, because you need to be right on top of your game if you are going to be good at it. So there will come a balance when you, as you do less and less, you are not going to be sharp enough or up to date enough to be able to give the right sort of advice and work. So that, to me, there is a balance there. But at the moment, that balance I feel is good. I still do a bit and I still enjoy it. I have actually got some, these are event horses, but some young horses that I bought to help to produce into the eventing world, and I'm enjoying doing that. And if there was a trainer phoning up and wanting me to come and work with a racehorse, I would certainly do that. And if a young jockey picked up the telephone and wanted to have some advice, I would certainly not turn them away. I would be delighted to do that. I still have an involvement in Sweden with the Swedish Olympic Committee and the Swedish Equestrian Federation across dressage and show jumping and eventing.
So you're still in the game?
Still in the game, yes.
Good. And you don't need me to tell you that obviously you're incredibly well respected, and long may it continue. But
it's been great to have an involvement, and it's you meet some wonderful people that are like minded and interested in it. And I mean, to me, it's a wonderful sport. It caters for everyone. I mean, you just have to go to a race meeting to see the whole range of people that go and get fun out of it. And in the centre of that is what is a wonderful, wonderful creature, which is the horse.
Yogi Breisner then, and I hope you got a lot out of that. You've probably heard his name if you listen to Racing Folk for long enough. But I hope that I was able to give you an insight into the knowledge and just the sheer enthusiasm the man has for horses and for horse racing, and for the role he continues to play in maximising the performance of racehorses and jockeys. A few bits and pieces of housekeeping about the podcast before I weigh in then for this episode. As I've been promising pretty much from the word go, I've finally delivered on launching a website to buddy up with these podcasts. You'll find it at www.rap.chat. And you'll need to type that into the address bar at the top of your web browser for now, since it's not been around long enough yet to score on Google search engine optimized software. Have a deco at the website, as I really want it to deliver more visual-only information to supplement the verbals on these podcasts. I'm also hoping it's going to be a place where listeners and readers can give feedback on content I'm putting out, share the crack, and generally have a laugh and have a say, which is basically what The Rap is all about. A final teaser to leave you with, I'm in the process of talking with a guy whose racing knowledge and opinions, and above all his work ethic, I totally respect, who I'm hoping is going to become a regular sparring partner with me on the podcast. He's going to be someone that I can look back with on each week's racing, look forward to what's coming up in our little world, and generally chew the fat about all things racing. It's great to have other people's voices and opinions on the podcast, and I'm not precious in the slightest about saying so. I hope to have something to share on this score with the Rap listenership in the next episode, so stay tuned for that. Okay, that's it for this episode. Thanks very much indeed again, as always, for showing up. I never take your attendance lightly, but for now, That's a wrap.